Welcome. Today is the 1st of December, 2009. we do this every month as an offering. How are you, Nigel? This is a monthly planner for December. If you're interested in this, it's out there on the table, and it tells you what are the best days of the month, but in a very general manner. This has nothing to do with your personal birth chart. This has everything to do with where the planets are in the sky on a given day. So it's far more complex in reality than what is printed here. But this could be of great value. If you don't have a page, don't worry about it. It's on my website. It's on the front page. Down on the right says monthly planners. So I've divided them into gold days, silver days, bronze days, and gray days. And they simply mean, you know what all that means. We all do. That's why I use those terms. So bronze days would be regular days, average days, in which to do any work. The way I've described it here at the bottom, they are general indications of each day and are to be used when planning important work, business, and purchases. So bronze days are average days. Silver days are very strong and favorable. Gold days are really strong and favorable. And then gray days, as far as possible, should be avoided for important things, like getting married, buying a car, buying a house, these kinds of things. Things that you really want to have succeed. Now, again, it's very general, but it's there and it's available. We had a few days, a few months go by with no gold days whatsoever. And in this month, we have three. And then we have about four or five silver days. So it's pretty good. It's a pretty good month, all in all. Today's a silver day. So the moon is in Taurus. The full moon is tomorrow. So when it's a full moon, the moon is here in the sky and the sun is there, directly opposite. And a moon it's at its most powerful when it's full. And the moon is the mind, the emotions, the heart of the cosmic person. So when the moon is exalted, it happens to be full and exalted in Taurus. So it's fantastic. If you have any purchases that are really important for you, tomorrow would be a real good idea. If you can do that. Anything that's important could be quite agreeably done tomorrow. Anyway, that's there for you. And some time back we did an introduction to a meditation or learn to meditate workshop. We did it, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago or so. That went over pretty well. So we're going to do another one of those on Saturday, January 16th. And then the other night I went down to Temple Bar and I addressed a group of people there, Conscious Living Dublin, and I did just a short lecture on finding your life purpose. That went over pretty well, so I'm going to do I've done it many times in the past, but I'm going to do a Finding Your Life Purpose workshop on Sunday, January 17th, if you're interested. Flyers are out there. Okay. Yeah, one's meditation, but the same as you did before. Yeah. So, and then the finding your life purpose. Okay. Now, I told you last time, a month ago, that I would talk a little bit about Rahu and Ketu having moved in the sky. So I wrote this today, so I'm going to more or less read from it. Rahu enters Sagittarius and Ketu enters Gemini. Since Rahu and Ketu in the half-light always travel in concert, although 180 degrees apart, let us look at this new phase of Rahu's and Ketu's transit through the signs of Sagittarius and Gemini, respectively. Rahu and Ketu will enter these signs on November 2, 2009 and remain there for the next 1.5 years. So it's typically 18 months. Until May 3, 2011. For the most part, Rahu and Ketu travel backwards in motion. Whereas the other planets travel forwards unless they go into retrograde motion, but primarily they travel forwards. Rahu and Ketu always travel backwards. The next year and a half should enable us to lighten up and laugh a little more, appreciating the irony, inscrutability, and karmic nature of the circumstances in which we find ourselves. Comedy, humor, and laughter will get us through. Tears may provide a release, but they will not get you out the other end of your predicament. But laughter will. Our third eye of spiritual vision will become more opened on a collective level. Insight, perception, intuition, and revelation is likely to increase for many. That's Ketu in Gemini. More time spent in meditation will actually will personally help you bring this about for yourself or for the world at large, if that is your stage. Your power of suggestion or transference of thoughts and ideas into the minds and hearts of others will also increase. A couple of good suggestions to world leaders wouldn't hurt. Be careful to curb a sharp tongue and critical speech. Again, Ketu in Gemini. They can cut deeper than you think. It's like holding a gun which accidentally goes off and shoots somebody. Telling them you didn't mean to wound them may be too little, too late. Choose your words carefully. We talked about this last time considerably. People's beliefs, goals, objectives, ethics, and values will transform dramatically in some cases. This is Rahu in Sagittarius now. In light of this past year's economic events, corporations, banks, governments, institutions, investments, currencies, retirement plans, etc., may not be given the place of honor they were once previously afforded. Since our collective faith has really been tested of late, we are learning that we cannot place so much faith in material and temporal persons, circumstances, and institutions. How many people have lost faith in some of these things in the last year? Only one person. That's pretty good. More than one. This is a difficult lesson to learn, but the teacher is now leaning over us with a hard cane, ready to deliver the next blow. The time has come in which to learn some of these painful lessons and change our old ways of thinking and reconsider our placement of trust. This is really what this is about. It's to teach you that whatever they've told you is worth putting your trust into is not necessarily. And blind trust is generally rewarded with blindness. So this is the deeper karmic meaning of what's going on in our world at this time. Since it is the daily duty of each and every person to take one step closer to their own truth, this simple act has never been more critical than at this time in our collective evolution. We have been misled and let down by untruth, cheating, misrepresentation, selfishness, greed, and deception. All for the aggrandizement of the few to the detriment of the many. Cheaters will now be exposed in greater numbers. We must have the courage and conviction to purge ourselves and our society of our lower self-centered nature in all its forms. All dharma or virtue is based upon truth. Our actions and our words must be coherent. If we speak and act with such coherence and send that vibration out into the universe, won't that same authenticity come back to us? In this way, drawing upon our own clear intent, let us create for ourselves a more desirable reality and a world of greater integrity. This is all about Rahu being in Sagittarius, because Sagittarius is dharma, virtue, truth, integrity, and Rahu is the shadow. So this is all about exposing the shadow side of that. You know, we've seen here in the last several days, the clergy representing truth and piety, God, and doing exactly the opposite. That's real. Rahu and Sagittarius. For example, there are other examples. With Rahu as the external force now in Sagittarius, our energies must be focused on bringing about a revolution in dharma, virtue, truth, and honesty. With Ketu as the internal force now in Gemini, our intuitive analytical power must quickly enable us to know the truth when we see it, to recognize it, free from confusion. Rahu's energy goes outward, Ketu's energy travels inward. Yeah. Especially if you're doing something that you don't really want to do. It's one thing to make sacrifices sometimes on behalf of others out of love to help out. No one's going to say anything about that or against that. It's a whole other thing to continually compromise yourself and sell yourself short and deny your truth and pretend everything's okay, because that will be the source of a slow death for you. You will slowly and systematically kill yourself off over time because you're too far out of sync with yourself. The universe, as we've said in the past, stays together, and all the planets stay in orbit because of integrity, integration. The more we are out of integrity, the more we begin to disintegrate. We fall apart, and the ultimate falling apart is known as death. You know, there are actually documented cases of yogis who have died, left their bodies, and their bodies didn't decay for months, sometimes years on end. Now, they're dead and gone, but because they lived, and this is a world where there is death, so don't let me tell you different. But because they lived with such a high degree and state of consciousness and integrity in that body, that when they left that body, which is really the soul just leaving the body, going elsewhere, the body still vibrated at that state. Paramahansa Yogananda was what you saw him.
Do you remember we saw that body in India?
That wasn't him. That was another one. Yeah.
That was
scary. Oh, that was Ramanuja. Now, he was hundreds of years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. We saw him in India in February. Okay. Well, I thought because it was Christmas time almost. I would talk a little bit about. I found a really nice article here. I had it on my computer that I had saved. This is Christmas's pagan origins. This is an article by a woman called Kelly Whitman. And it appeared in a magazine called the East Texas Review. Yeah, here is a little about the real origins of many of the Christmas customs that are still observed. Most of them have nothing to do with Christianity. Most of them were in place before Christianity was established. I don't know how many of you know that, but I found that quite curious. Probably a lot of you do. Few people realize that the origins of a form of Christmas was pagan and celebrated in Europe long before anyone there had heard of Jesus Christ. No one knows what day Jesus Christ was born on. From the biblical description, most historians believe that his birth probably occurred in September, approximately 6 months after Passover. I'm going to read something very startling to you at the end of all this. One thing they agree on is that it is very unlikely that Jesus was born in December, since the Bible records shepherds tending their sheep in the fields on that night, which they probably wouldn't be doing in December. It would be chilly. There might be sheep in the fields, but I don't know if the shepherds would be there or not. This is quite unlikely to have happened during a cold Judean winter. So why do we celebrate Christ's birthday as Christmas on December the 25th? The answer lies in the pagan origins of Christmas. In ancient Babylon, the feast of the son of Isis, the goddess of nature, was celebrated on December 25th. Raucous partying, gluttonous eating, drinking, and gift giving were the traditions of this feast. And here in Ireland, we aim to carry it forward. In Rome, the winter solstice, of course, the most important point of this, was celebrated many years before the birth of Christ. The Romans called their winter holiday, what, do you know? It's the name of a planet. Saturnalia, after Saturn. Huh? Interesting, huh? Honoring Saturn, the god of agriculture. So it was almost like a kind of a harvest celebration, I guess. Of course, remember, if that was in Italy, the growing season's a little bit longer there and warm, so December may have worked. In January, they observed the calends of January. Maybe that's where they get the word calendar from. Which represented the triumph of life over death. This whole season was called Dies Batalis Invicti Solis, the birthday of the unconquered sun. Because the sun, from the solstice, begins to do what?
To rise.
To increase. To increase, the rise earlier, 1 degree per day. 1 degree, so 1 minute, 1 degree. The festival season was marked by much merrymaking. It seems to be consistent. It is in ancient Rome that the tradition of the mummers was born. Ever heard of the mummers? What's her name? Who's the Canadian girl that I really like that sings? Lorena McKennitt. Yeah, that was Celine Dion. No, Lorena McKennitt. Lorena McKennitt sings one called A Mummer's Dance. The mummers were groups of costumed singers and dancers who traveled from house to house entertaining their neighbors. From this, the Christmas tradition of caroling was born. In Northern Europe, many other traditions that we now consider part of Christianity, or of Christmas worship, pardon me, were begun long before the participants had ever heard of Christ. The pagans of Northern Europe celebrated their own winter solstice known as... You ought to know. Yule. Yule was symbolic of the pagan sun god, what's his name? Mithras. Being born... and was observed on the shortest day of the year, because from there on in he begins to expand and the days get longer. As the sun god grew and matured, the days became longer and warmer. It was customary to light a candle to encourage Mithras and the sun to reappear next year. The lighting of candles. Huge Yule logs were burned in honor of the sun. The word Yule itself means wheel. Wheel. The wheel being a pagan symbol for the sun and also for the year, no? The cycle. Mistletoe was considered a sacred plant, and the custom of kissing under the mistletoe began as a fertility ritual. I wish you fertility. Holly berries were thought to be a food of the gods. Right? So mistletoe is normally found where? On oak trees. And who used to send out parties to collect mistletoe? The Druids. And Drew means? Oak. Druids. The oak people. And they collect mistletoe and use it in their ceremony. Various ceremonies. Okay. The tree is the one symbol that unites almost all Northern European winter solstices. Live evergreen trees were often brought into homes during the harsh winters as a reminder to inhabitants that soon their crops would grow again. Live evergreen trees, not dead ones. Nowadays, we just kill them off, bring them in, and watch the needles fall all over the place. Evergreen boughs were sometimes carried as totems of good luck and were often present at weddings representing fertility. Interesting, huh? Yeah. The Druids used the tree as a religious symbol, holding their sacred ceremonies while surrounding and worshiping huge trees. The Druids. In 350, Pope Julius I declared that Christ's birth would be celebrated on December 25th. I guess same as whatever we said earlier there, that was on the 25th.
Yeah.
ISIS. Yeah. There is little doubt that he was trying to make it as painless as possible for pagan Romans, who remained a majority at that time, to convert to Christianity. The new religion went down a bit easier, knowing that their feasts would not be taken away from them and disturbed. Christmas, Christ Mass, as we know it today, most historians agree, began in Germany, though Catholics and Lutherans still disagree about which church celebrated it first. It's not the only thing they disagree about. The earliest record of an evergreen being decorated in a Christian celebration was in 1521 in the Alsace region of Germany. A prominent Lutheran minister of the day cried, "Blasphemy, better that they should look to the true tree of life, Christ." The controversy continues even today. So, that's interesting. Most of these celebrations and customs were already in place. Now, here's the one that might turn you on your ear here. We've never actually shared this with too many people because it is just challenging to the Christian ethic. But I'll share it with you now. This is from a book by a guy called Tony Bushby, or it's from an article by Tony Bushby. A lot of scholarship went into writing. There's a book that goes with this. If you're interested in checking up on this, you can. And you can look at this and get the information. In the 4th century, the Roman Emperor Constantine, you probably heard of him, united all religious factions under one composite deity and ordered the compilation of new and old writings into a uniform collection that became the New Testament of the Bible. Constantine was the emperor at that time. We're talking about, I think it was like 1500, 1600. What? Was it 300? Maybe it was. We're going to find out here in a minute. Constantine wasn't Roman. He wasn't Italian. He was British. He was British. But Britain was part of the Roman Empire at the time. Here is an interesting excerpt from the article. It's only one paragraph. At the end of that time, Constantine returned to the gathering. And a lot of this is in the Vatican Library in Rome. That's where this guy got most of it. At the end of that time, but people don't study it. They just, you know, people don't study things. They just sort of go word of mouth. At the end of that time, Constantine returned to the gathering to discover that the presbyters were the religious thinkers of the time. The preachers, the thinkers, the Brahmins, the priests. That the presbyters had not agreed on a new deity, but had balloted down to a short list of 5 prospects. He said, "We got to get one deity here. We can pull all this together, all of these different disparate ways of thinking, put it all together and get the church on the right path." So he told them to do that, but they came down with 5. Caesar, Krishna, Mithra or Mithras, which we just mentioned, Horus from Egypt, and Zeus. Those are the big 5. Caesar was a man. He was a leader. And this is from Historia Ecclesiastica, Eusebius, circa 325. Emperor Constantine was the ruling force at Nicaea, or the ruling spirit at Nicaea, and he ultimately decided upon a new god for them because they couldn't make up their minds which one they'd focus on. To involve British factions, he was British. He ruled that the name of the great Druid god, Hesus, or Hesus, would be joined with the Eastern savior god, Krishna. Krishna is Sanskrit for Christ. Is it? Well, not exactly, but that's what it says here. And thus, Jesus Krishna would be the official name of the new Roman god. A vote was then taken, and it was a majority show of hands, 161 votes to 157 in favor, that both divinities became one. Jesus Krishna. Following long-standing heathen custom, Constantine used the official gathering and the Roman apotheosis decree to legally deify the two deities into one, and did so by democratic consent. Apotheosis, in case you don't know, is the law that you can elevate someone to the status of a divinity. That's the decree he used. Just like they elevated Caesar to a status of divinity, did they not? They worship Caesar. A new god was proclaimed and officially ratified by Constantine. The act was called Acta Concilii Nicene 1618, it says here. That purely political act of deification effectively and legally placed Jesus and Krishna among the Roman gods as one individual composite. That abstraction lent earthly existence to amalgamated doctrines for the empire's new religion. So they declared a deity. Now they pulled all these different pieces of doctrine from all these different places. And that, okay, I said that. And because there was no letter J in alphabets around the 9th century, the name subsequent, so it was Jesus Krishna, the name subsequently evolved into Jesus Christ. So how many of you heard this before?
I've heard parts of it before.
So, and then if you read on, he says that most of the birth, childhood, pastimes of Jesus Christ are taken directly from Mithras, the Persian deity. It's almost word for word, all the different things that happen.
And Krishna's childhood too.
Yeah, there's stuff there from Krishna's childhood as well. Like the flood and quite a few different things. Killing off the firstborn. And
teacher.
Yeah. So, interesting. Questions? Comments?
So Jesus is a fictional character?
According to this? Yeah.
So during his test, he found that in Vatican?
Yeah.
Library?
But you can't control the people until you round them up and you point them all in the same direction. That was the whole idea there. You have to control the people. And you have to, if you're either an emperor or a spiritual leader, you have to make the people depend on you to think that they can't approach God without you. And that gives the clergy their legitimacy and their hold.
That's what they did in Ireland.
That's what they've done in many civilizations over time. And we saw another. We saw a video when we were living in L.A. Kalindi and I, and you know, he died, and on the third day he rose again. That's the same what the sun does at the solstice.
21st and 25th.
Yeah. Yeah.
Three stars coming up with three shepherds.
Yeah. So that you can investigate that if you like. There's lots been said about that. It just fits with the way the sun. Jesus is the Son of God. So interesting, huh? So
the Druids too, they have a sun very similar to the Mass, which would have been there way before Mass was.
Yeah, I mean, because all this stuff predated New Testament, you know, how they've amalgamated and turned, made the sacrifice of the Mass and all the rest of this, and so much of this was going on. And to, you know, I've always found it rather offensive to criticize so-called pagan religion when pagan religion is you know, it's earth-based, it's pantheistic, it sees God everywhere, it worships God through nature and the elements, the movement of the planets, the sun. I mean, that's God. That's God in what's called the universal form. So how can you just dismiss that wholesale? It reminds me of being raised in Canada, where I was raised with many, many Canadian Indians. I grew up with them. And, you know, their culture was just raped, stolen, destroyed, ripped from them. And that it was all nonsense. It didn't recognize Jesus Christ and the Catholic Church and the rest of it. You know, their culture was more spiritual in and of itself, being that it was so close to the earth. And than the European so-called spiritual culture ever was. And even that I saw when I was a child. I could see that.
One of the first people on that side of the world to accept reincarnation. The reincarnation was also a circle of balance that they had. So they never took anything. They never hunted or killed anything because... unless they were aiming for food or survival.
Right. And they also blessed it and thanked it for giving up its spirit so that they could use its body, its meat, etc. But it's interesting you mentioned that point because the Sanskrit word... Do you know the Sanskrit word for meat?
No.
The Sanskrit word for meat is mamsa. Mamsa. It's made up of two words. Mam... sa, me, he. I eat he eats me. Same. Okay. So there's my Yuletide tidings. Well, I don't. I'm not trying to beat anybody over the head with this. I'm just only making it available. When I first read this, I was gobsmacked, you know. But then again, kind of knowing how things have gone and how different cultures have tried to dupe people over the years for different reasons, it's not a big stretch. And the level of scholarship that this person has gone to is nothing short of amazing. What's really amazing is all this information is in the Vatican Library, but nobody pays attention to it. You know? I mean, if believing in Catholicism, Christianity, and Jesus increases your virtue, then I'm all for it. You know? If it improves your life and improves your behavior and how you treat others, great. Okay. I was reading the other day the Mahabharata, which is one of the historical books in Sanskrit. It consists of 100,000 verses of poetry. That's a lot. And I've shared this with you from time to time, the Mahabharata. The Bhagavad Gita is a very small part of the Mahabharata. But here, right here in 1-4 verses is the whole essence of spirituality. So I thought it might be nice to share that with you. The speaker here is Brihaspati. Brihaspati, anybody know who he is? Jupiter. Jupiter. What's another name for Jupiter? Guru. Oh, you've been listening. Good. I'm pleased. The Guru. Now, if you take the English word Jupiter and you break it into two and you de-anglicize it, you'll get the Sanskrit Dhyaupita. Dhyaupita. And a pitta is a
father.
And Dhyau means of the sky. Dhyaupita is the father of the sky. So Jupiter or Brihaspati or Dhyaupita is the chief priest among the gods, the celestials, divine beings, angels, archangels. This is the chief priest. This is the advisor for those people. Okay. And he says, contentment is the highest heaven and the greatest bliss. Contentment. Gee, you'd think it'd be something more complicated than that, wouldn't you? There is nothing superior to contentment. Contentment is above all. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, why even begin to talk about happiness? There can be no happiness without contentment. So if we chase desires, we say, I'm going to fulfill this desire, then I'll be happy. And then I'll fulfill this desire, I'll be happy. But desires are like rivers heading toward the ocean. They never end. So you may fulfill one or two or three, it doesn't matter. I'm not saying you shouldn't fulfill your desires. Let's be clear. But desires, the fulfillment of desires, the satisfaction gained is only temporary. Whereas contentment means there is no desire. When one contracts or pulls in all his desires, like a tortoise drawing in all his limbs, then the natural effulgence of his soul soon manifests itself. When you pull in your desires, withdraw them or contract them like a turtle, pulling in the limbs, then the natural effulgence of the soul. Effulgence means? Shine, shining. Light. The natural light of the soul will begin to manifest. That's two verses. When one does not fear any creature, nor is any creature frightened by you. One does not fear any creature, nor is any creature frightened by you. When one contracts one's desire and hatred, well, what's other terms for desire and hatred? attraction, repulsion. Positive attachment, negative attachment. Desire and hatred. When one contracts one's desire and hatred, then is one said to see one's soul. So that's the qualification. You want to see your soul? You want to be introduced to your soul? You want to have a clear vision of you as a soul? Then you must not fear any creature. The only way you cannot fear any creature is if no creature is afraid of you. So, if we kill creatures, then creatures have a reason to be afraid of us. Right? When one contracts one's desire and hatred, so one does not judge. Stops judging. I love that group. I hate that group. You can appreciate whoever you want, but don't be overly positively attached to one thing and overly negatively critical of another. Not easy to do. It's not easy to do. Then one is able to see one's soul. When one seeks to injure nobody in thought, word, and deed, that one you know, and cherishes no desire, if there's no desire, there's nothing to have to do. This is a very elevated state, my friends. Very, very elevated. So I don't want you to go home and think, well, gee, I'm not on that level. I don't want you to go home and get bummed out. Just take from this what you can. That's all. He is then said to attain to Brahman.
Sounds what?
And Brahman is? What is Brahman? Spirit. Spirit. Brahman.
Are you talking about being
in that state?
In the true sense.
Mm-hmm. Being in the state of Brahman. Fully conscious. Sat Chit Ananda. Experiencing eternity. Sat Chit, knowledge or full consciousness, and Ananda, bliss. So that's the essence of spirituality. So practically speaking, practically, what should we do with this? I think if you'd pick one thing of among that which is mentioned. What is mentioned here? Becoming content. This is a big theme here. Contracting desire. Trying to diminish your desire. If it doesn't have to be all. Trying to be a little less desireful. For example, not going shopping for no particular reason. Some people go shopping to shop. They don't really need anything, but you might find something. That could be contracted, for example. Like a tortoise withdrawing the limbs. So you could, that could be one of the things. Or not fearing any creature. And no creature having the cause of fearing you. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. It does.
Most people will judge a person.
Right. But to do this, it means to transcend that. So it doesn't matter where they're at or how they may judge, because you're actually floating above it. Many years ago, my son and I took my son to a football game in Los Angeles, downtown, city center. Use your imagination. And we went to the game, and then we were going back to find our car, and we got lost. Because you can, as you approach the stadium, the Coliseum, L.A. Coliseum, there's people going like this: park here, $5; park here, $10. You know, they open up their yard. You can park. You know, it's hard to find parking. So we parked someplace and forgot exactly where it was. The place is huge. And we're walking through, and next thing we know, we're in the ghetto. We are in the black ghetto. And you know when you're in the ghetto? When you're in the ghetto. And it's getting dark. And up ahead, as we're walking down the street, is 10 black guys standing on the sidewalk where we're walking. 10 young black men. And my son looks up at me, up and he goes, "Dad?" And I said, "Yeah. What are we going to do?" I says, "What do you mean then? We're going to look for the car. That's what we're doing." And I walked. I didn't walk around either side. I walked right through the middle of them. I said, "Hey, how's it going?" And I didn't do that because I was afraid, because I wasn't afraid. If you believe that there's going to be an issue, there may well be an issue. If you're giving out a signal of fear, and there's a predator, they'll come. But when you walk like you own the sidewalk, and you walk through the midst of all that, like there's nothing going on, they said, "Hey, yeah, hey, how's it going?" And that was it. And, you know, we found a car. Went home. There's no reason for fear. Not really. They weren't being threatening. They didn't have an attitude. They didn't say anything mean. You know? I mean, just using that as an example. I'm not saying to be foolish around people who are I don't know, drunk, crazed, have a broken bottle in their hand. That's separate.
That's, in that situation, you better avoid it.
In that situation, of course, you avoid it. Yeah. I mean, you don't go looking for trouble. Don't get me wrong. So does everybody have... Let's try this mantra here. Siddharshan Chakra Mantra of Vishnu. Everybody have that? Yeah, we've done this one before. Now, Vishnu is a name for God in the Vedic tradition. And it means... God, he who lives everywhere, he is all pervasive. And Vishnu sometimes, well, Vishnu almost always appears in a forearm form. Can you imagine what it'd be like if you had two extra arms? Wouldn't you be able to do so much more? And assuming that your brain could accommodate the extra arms. When Vishnu appears in his two-arm form, he's known as Krishna. There's Krishna in the middle on the altar, on the left with the flute. That's Krishna. He's quite a good flute player. That's Vishnu. On the far right side, on the all the way to the right, is Lakshmi, goddess of fortune. And next to Lakshmi is the four-armed Vishnu. Up in his upper right arm, you see his chakra. Sudarshan Chakra. Chakra means wheel, right? Or disc. And that's one of his weapons. Up in his left hand is conch shell, shunk. And then in his lower right hand is a club. Gada. And then in his left hand is a... I love this. Shankha Chakra Gada Padma. So, this mantra is used to destroy negativity, darkness, evil, bad karma, negative planetary afflictions, enemies, and misfortune. It also confers a sense of peace and well-being and gives complete protection from all onslaughts. Now, in a perfect world, of course, there's nothing wrong in your life and no one ever gives you a hard time, including Jennifer's boss. But we do, from time to time, come across different problems. Vishnu is God, and the Sudarshan Chakra is one of his weapons used in overcoming Maya, or illusion, as well as material ego, demoniac forces, envious persons, destructive elements, and atheistic beliefs. It's interesting, atheistic beliefs, and why is that important? Well, because there's theism and there's atheism, or non-theism. In the absence of God, there is only ego. And if it's ego running the show, we're all in trouble. Big trouble. So that's why it's very, very important to have God. If you don't like that term, spirit at the center. Extremely important. Spirit is eternal and spirit is dependable. Ego, not eternal, not dependable, and pretty much self-indulgent. Okay. So this mantra, interestingly, is made up of several bija mantras. Bija means seed. Seed mantras. So let me say it a few times. Om Sam Hum Sram Ram Hum Phat. Om Sam Hum Sram. Wait. Just let me say it a couple times. Om Sam Hum Sram Ram Hum Phat. Now, you can say Phat, or you can say Phat. Om Sam Hum Sram Ram Hum 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 Phat. Okay, you ready? Let's go. Om Sam Hum Sram Ram Hum Phat. 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 Om Sam Ram Sram Ram Hum Phat. Om Sam Hum Sram Ram Hum Phat. Om Sam Hum Sram Ram Hum Phat. Om Sam Hum Sram Ram Hum Phat. Om Sam Ram Sram Ram Hum Phat. Okay, 1 second. Okay, let's do it. Let's do it a little quicker. Om Sam Hum Sram Ram Hum Phat. Om Sam Hum Sram Ram Hum Phat. Om Sam Hum Sram Ram Hum Phat. Om Sam Ram Sram Ram Hum Phat. Om Sam Ham Sram Ram Hum Pat. Om Sam Ram 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 Sram Ram Hum Pat. Om Sam Ham Sram Ram Hum Pat. Om Sam Ram 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 Sram Ram Hum Pat. Om Sam Ham 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 Sram Ram Hum Pat. Om Sam Ram Sram Ram Hum Pat. Okay, very good. So, what mantra did we do a month ago? Om Namo Narayanaya. Has anybody worked with that over the past month? And? How was it? What happened?
I've been using it before my Lakshmi mantra for 41 days, so we finished our project. It's great, yeah. It closes the mantra down the lane.
Catherine, that's Catherine there, if you don't know Catherine. Catherine, we've known Catherine now for a number of years. And Catherine is very dedicated in her spiritual practice. And she's always chanting her mantras. And she's a painter. And she chants as she paints. Recently, Catherine's dad died. Just less than a month ago. And I think they buried him, what, a week ago?
About the 18th.
And Catherine came tonight. She arrived this evening. And she was remarking how she hasn't been suffering. She hasn't suffered. She's quite close to her dad, as far as I know. But she hasn't suffered. I said, well, were you supposed to suffer? And I haven't been, you know, haven't had bouts of crying. And no. Yeah. So I'm just using Catherine as an example of somebody who's really getting the benefit of all the time and effort she's put in her spiritual practice. Because one of the hardest things anybody can go through is the death of a loved one, not to speak of the parents. The parents are, can never be replaced. You know. So, it's very good. She came before, just before the funeral, and the other night she came and I gave her the funeral prayers at the time of a soul's passing. And these are all, of course, from the Vedas. I said, these are great prayers. You should maybe chant those. Or just say them, just the English. I did for my father's eulogy when my father died. I spoke the eulogy and I said those prayers. She said, oh, these are great. I don't think they'll... Oh, no, they wouldn't let me say that. They would just be, you know, no, 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 you don't understand. I said, well, see what you can do. And Catherine said all the prayers out loud at the gravesite or in the church? In the church.
And I may it be a, because it's meant to be the Lord hear us.
And now may the Lord hear our prayer. He said at the end.
To make it look like it was part of
it. Get it right in there, you know.
No.
In English.
It's the last bit. It's about truth. It's about the truth. And it's interesting because of all the people, like one of my brothers who I haven't really been getting on well with, he was, it's years after it's going, that was the most profound thing you've ever said. And I was like, oh, thanks. So I was just, well, again, like, thanks to like yourselves, you know, Clancy, for putting on these nights, because this has been my medicine for all my stuff. So,
doing spiritual practice is all very well and good, but it's the test that's important, and the tests will come, and that's how you find out how well you're doing and how far you've come, my dear. So, well, when you get tested, how you react in a situation like this, somebody close to you dies, how do you behave? People experience all different kinds of emotions, grief being a natural one. People get very angry sometimes, and, you know, feeling victimized, so many different things. Families can get into heated arguments, not only during Thanksgiving dinner as in America, but and Christmas, but the death of a loved one also can bring out all kinds of stuff. Because families are like, you know, these mobiles that hang, and they got the different things, and they go like this, and they're all in a state of balance, but they bob. Those are that's a family. So when you cut one off, it goes like this. You've just removed a very important element, whoever it might be, especially a parent. And that throws everyone off. Somebody was here last week and said that her mother used to always be at her and, you know, be very critical of her. And then the mother died, and within 3 days, the younger sister immediately began to criticize her, taking up the slack of the mother's criticism. I mean, she didn't even realize she was doing it, but you see, nature abhors a vacuum. We're not even conscious sometimes. Okay, anybody want to share any circumstances or insights? Anything you had happened in the last month?
Since I come from Dublin for a year and a half, and then getting into spirituality, I found sometimes that people use this word as a glamorized word or fashionable word, and then just to track, or like, and sometimes I see the people like, and they just look, oh, I said, there's lots of energy there, right? And sometimes they use this word just to impress the people. They don't actually make a real sense of that. And they will talk about this chakra, this and that, and they don't actually properly know about this.
You noticed?
I noticed that, but now boom, more and more I'm going these thing lectures, and they do include this, and people say, that's work on your energy level and chakra, this. And they don't actually, sometimes I don't agree with that, even the explanation they give that. And I just think that it just could be, they just glamorize this word, same as like in some time, the yoga philosophy, they glamorize this thing because people know.
Yeah. Well, I have said here on more than one occasion that there's a lot of people in the New Age field, if you want to call it that, who really, the vast majority of people in the New Age field are, who knows why they're in the New Age field, you know. It's like anything. You have to be very careful about who you go and take instruction from, you know. And this is something where people will jump on the bandwagon because it's trendy and it's cool and it's fun. And then there's a whole other segment of people to think that there's a few euros in it. And that's another reason to do it. There's lots of people like that. So, you know, mostly you'll get a lot of imposters. I was into spirituality before there was a New Age movement. And, I lived in Los Angeles for 22 years, so that's where a lot of it was spawned. I met lots of these people. I mean, I know them. I met them. And, there you have the full-on experience. Here it's kind of like the smaller experience, but similar.
Yeah.
But, you know, there, that would have all peaked back in the early 80s.
That's very funny, but that's actually very risky anyway. Like,
to use your discretion. You have to use your discrimination. Just because somebody starts talking about something, that doesn't make them an authority in it. And, I've seen lots of cases where people have been worked on by some person. It's created more problems than anything. Mm-hmm. One of the things you have to be very, very careful about is not becoming a workshop junkie. And getting too much work done, or having too many people work on you. You know, Monday I'm having a chakra balancing, Tuesday I'm having acupuncture, Thursday I'm having this, Friday I'm having that. No. If you want to make yourself out of balance and ungrounded, just keep it up, because it'll happen in no time. And then you'll wonder what hit you. With spirituality, like anything else, but especially in spirituality, just a little bit at a time. Just a little bit, and give yourself time to assimilate. Do something, and then let it sink in. You know, let it, if it's shifting you favorably, give it time to shift you favorably. Don't go to something different the next day. It's too much.
Just like a Kundalini yoga, actually. Just, and I don't agree with them as well. And they are like, you know, like a Maggie was telling, she's doing like a Om Satanama, Om Satanama, and Mark. And I say, Satanama is that's more something to do with Sikhism. Because where I born in the city Amritsar, 60% people are Sikh, and that's where the Golden Temple is. And I say, that's not the real Kundalini. They should be like, Om Bhur, Om Boha, Om Swaha, Om Maha, Om Janaha, Om Tapha, Om Satyam. That's what should be. All the other words are Mam, Ram, or Lam for your thyroid gland. Satanama. I say that. She said, but it really works. I say, yes, maybe the physical, the way the posture they're doing, they're really working and the meditation working. But Satanama, I say, I can add my name, M-A-R-C-U-S, M-A-R-C-U-S, M-A-R-C-U-S. Yoga is 5,000 years, 10,000 years, philosophy is. And Sikhism actually born about 400-500 years ago. How could you actually do that? But then I found that what happened, the Sikhism, when they found it, they have, missionary kind of thing. They say, how are we going to spread Sikhism in the West? Can we ask them to have a turban? I said, Western people are not going to like that. Grow really big beard and that. I don't think so, right? So what we do then? What's the proper thing the Western people attract to the East is? They say spirituality, yoga. Oh yeah, yoga, right? So the link mix up with yoga. This is her Bhajan yogi, right?
Yogi Bhajan.
Yeah, Bhajan. And then he just got the idea from Prabhupada, right? Hare Rama Krishna, that movement. And he said that he went there, he just teaches this for all the, junkies there or hippies there, and then the spread. He said, why don't we just link this with the yoga, right, Kundalini yoga, and do it there. But in the Sikhism there...
They don't do those things.
They have nothing.
Right.
I lived with them, right. And there's nothing to do. But now in the West, the Kundalini yoga, even if they do the drink so far.
So it's manufactured.
Exactly.
It's manufactured religion. Scientology is manufactured religion. There's no God at the center.
I'm not hoping that the best way to make money is to start your own religion.
Yeah, that's what Rel Ron Hubbard said. He said, I'm going to go start my own religion, and I'm going to show you how gullible people are, and they'll take to this. I won't even have a God involved. And they said, oh, you nonsense. That'll never work. It did. Worked well.
It attracted a lot of celebrities, and I'm not saying that a lot of...
Well, that's one of their proselytizing campaigns to spread the word was specifically targeted at Hollywood celebrities.
Of course.
Okay. Let's meditate. Close your eyes, breathe, relax, and let go. Deeply, deeply relax. Breathe and let go. Allow the stress, tension, fear, and apprehension to drain from your body. Totally, completely relax. Breathe and let go. High above, envision a beautiful beam of radiant pearl white light coming down from the heavens, down, down, all the way down, entering through the top of your head, expanding throughout your head, torso, arms and legs, out the bottom of your feet, into the earth below. Breathe, relax, and let go. See and feel yourself by means of this light connected to the heavens above and grounded in the earth below. Floating in a boat on a peaceful, clear, calm lake. You have no oars, no paddles. Gently floating. On one side of the lake, you look at the bank, the shore, and what you see there is very attractive, compelling, desirable. What do you see there? On the opposite shore, what you see there is not compelling, unattractive, and not desirable. What do you see there? Now you have no paddles. No oars. So what will you do? Do you want to go over to the side that you find attractive? Or do you want to go over to the opposite side of the lake, where that isn't attractive, but maybe has something else important for you? Or do you want to go nowhere, remain where you are? Decide where you want to go. You have no or, so you must will yourself across the lake. You must intend on moving the boat in the direction in which you want to go. What happens? If you decide to go to one shore or the other shore, what happens when you reach there? Please continue until you've finished all the steps of the meditation. Once you've finished, please return to consciousness, awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed, and at peace.